Rare are among the most innovative and well-respected game companies of all time. I've explored their famed works on this podcast before, including titles like Banjo-Kazooie, Donkey Kong Country, and GoldenEye 007. Those are just a few of their best-loved releases, but they all go back to the 90s, when Rare were partnered with Nintendo. Unfortunately, I haven't yet covered any of their work since their acquisition by Microsoft in 2002, a controversial period that nonetheless resulted in a number of exciting new properties, like Viva Pinata. At the time of recording this podcast, their latest game is Sea of Thieves, a multiplayer pirate adventure complete with sailing, cutlasses, sea monsters, and even interactive shanties. Though given a cartoonish and playful feel, as is often the case with Rare, its creation and continued evolution are taken very seriously. That's exemplified in Sea of Thieves' music, which uses an arsenal of intriguing instruments in its authentic sound. In fact, its composer, Robin Beanland, received an Ivor Novello Award in 2019 for his inventive OST. But its strength and clever use of generative elements is to be expected from Robin, a Rare mainstay who cut his teeth on Killer Instinct before writing immensely popular scores like Conker's Bad Fur Day. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in-depth at video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. After leaving a huge Robin Beanland-shaped hole in my first series of VGM podcasts, I was particularly eager to speak to him for ST2. As a result, this is only the first of two appearances, with the second covering his output on the Nintendo 64. But before then, there's a whole ocean of insight to sail. So how did the voyage begin for Robin and the rest of the team behind Sea of Thieves?
When we sat down originally and sort of said, what's Sea of Thieves going to sound like? And I think it was Joe who said, I wonder what a pirate orchestra would sound like, you know, what would it even be? And it was kind of just thinking on that and thinking, well, we can go and record a real orchestra and do that like we've done on sort of previous games and stuff. But what would a pirate, it would be almost like instruments are a bit beaten up, maybe not great sounding, and the pirate almost not being, you know, wouldn't be a virtuoso, would just be sort of trying to get around a tune on it. And that's, you know, certainly with the shanties, that's where we landed on that. And I think all of that, we could have just played like a sample of a hurdy-gurdy, I suppose, but the all that kind of stuff of when you mic it up and you get all that scratchiness and all the button clicks and the intonation just going out a little bit, it just makes it sound more piratey to me.
Odd and somewhat antiquated instruments like the hurdy-gurdy are truly key to Sea of Thieves' immersive sound. A concertina, for example, can take you directly into the swashbuckling atmosphere simply by being played. But capturing some of the actual mechanics that drive the instrument too is exactly why Robin's soundtrack works so well. Despite the availability of high-quality concertina samplers, only the real thing would do the trick. And even then, the more battered its condition, the better. Provided you could still play it, of course.
We went to a shop called Hobgoblin in Birmingham, which is like a, I think there's quite a few around the UK, sort of like a folk instrument place. And they had this cabinet full of concertinas. And we kept getting them out and playing. I mean, I can't play a concertina. Just playing the odd notes just to hear this, what they sounded like. And they all sounded a bit clean and a bit nice. And then there was at the back of the cabinet, there was this student concertina, which is a little bit smaller, but it looked a bit beaten up. And we got it out and it's like it sounded a bit dull and some of the reeds were a bit kind of grating a bit and it was really creaky. The leather on the bellows was really creaky and we just went, that's it, it's perfect. And the guy in the shop was just looking at us like, you're nuts, aren't you? why are you going for that one, you know? But it was just like the sound. And we've since got another concertina because I wanted, it had more range on it basically. I wanted to be able to go lower in the range. And I've used it, but it does sound a lot cleaner. We still keep going back to that student one we've got, and it is in a bit of a state now. I need to get it. The bellows have got a little tear in; it's got a bit of a hole in, so it doesn't hold as much air as it once did. I'm very reluctant to get it refurbed because I don't want it to change the sound of it. Because to me, it sounds so piratey and creaky, and a bit, you know. I think it adds so much character.
Concertinas may be rarely heard outside of projects like Sea of Thieves, but they're still well known enough to avoid patronising you with an explanation of how they work. The similarly designed accordion remains relatively popular. Yet, when it comes to the hurdy-gurdy, a little background is required. Even its name is intriguing, but really, a hurdy-gurdy is quite similar to a fiddle. The main differences are that notes are defined by a keyboard instead of fingertips, and rather than a bow, the player uses a crank-operated wheel.
I must admit, when I first got the hurdy out, it frightened me quite because I thought, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get out of this. Because it sounded so, a bit like two cats fighting in a bag, really. It just, you know, it was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. And then, you know, eventually I bonded with it a fair bit. That wheel, you've got to handle it with care because you've got to be careful not to touch that wheel because if you get any sort of grease on anything, it won't, you get like a lump in your note. That's almost like the bow on the string. So if you get anything, you have to keep it really, you don't touch it at all, that. But I remember there's a shanty called Becalmed in Sea of Thieves, which has sort of been sort of fairly popular with people. But that was, I suppose the task I set myself with that was, how do I make this hurdy-gurdy sound like a sort of a pleasant instrument to listen to? And that was what I set about with that tune. And when I wrote the tune, I thought, I'm not sure, I wonder if people are going to go for this, if the team are going to like it or going to go. It's a bit kind of, just a bit sort of melancholy and a bit whatever, but they absolutely loved it. So I think it's probably most people's favourite tune, favourite shanty. But that was a case of trying to make the hurdy sound like a pleasant instrument to listen to, because I did do a lot of manipulation in Pro Tools with that, in terms of like volume fades and stuff, and making the sort of chords swell in and out. Because when you play the hurdy, it's not like a violin where you've got the bow on it and you can change the pressure of the bow on the string to play quieter. The hurdy is always the same tension on the string because it's just on that wheel. So it was, I had to do sort of quite a bit of a manipulation in Pro Tools to make those chords swell in and out and stuff, and make the melody line sort of not just hang, not a note just sustaining at the same volume, making it just fade out and make it sound a little bit sweeter. But I suppose that's another thing about Sea of Thieves, you weren't trying to be historically accurate with the instruments and things like that. It's just as long as it sounded believable and piratey, we went with it.
Historical accuracy is something that's come up before on the sound test, particularly in my Minecraft special with Gareth Coker, and the previous episode of this series, The Banner Saga. Interestingly, strict adherence to known facts about ancient music is often, to an extent, the wrong approach. With Minecraft's mythology packs, meeting people's expectations of a time and place was more important, and usually informed by films and other popular culture. In the Banner Saga's case, authentically Nordic roots provided little more than a vague flavour to Austin Wintory's strikingly original palette. So, when Robin came to play instruments like the hurdy-gurdy for Sea of Thieves, it was clear that a little manipulation would have to come into play.
You can't play chords on the hurdy. Oh, or you could. I've got three melody strings. I mean, I suppose you could tune them to a chord, but you can't change to a different sort of chord. So what I'd tend to do when I record a shanty is record the melody line first. In fact, I write it on a piano, and I write the melody separate, then the chords, and then I split the chords out into the individual notes within the chord, and put those onto different tracks in Pro Tools, and then I record each one of those lines individually. I suppose it's a bit like when you hear Brian May playing, you know, when he plays chords, those chord parts on Queen songs. I suppose it's a similar sort of technique. You just record the line at the top line of that chord, and then you go to the, say if it's like three notes in a chord, middle line and then bottom line, and then you've got your drone strings on the hurdy. Well, they just play one note, that's all they do. I suppose with hurdies, that's what sounds authentic for that instrument, but to me it's a bit sort of limiting in terms sort of harmonically, that I can't, you know, I would want some sort of bass line. So what I tend to do on that is just play the rhythm with the drone string, if you know what I mean, like when I'm cranking the wheel, sort of try and accent the beats, and then change that in melody. It'd be physically impossible to play that on a hurdy-gurdy. You could probably maybe do it with an ensemble of people. But I think, you know, when you play it in game, it sounds believable as, yeah, that sounds all right. Sounds like that's what's going on with this instrument.
Robin's process behind manipulating and expanding on live instrumentation is a wildly creative one. Using new technology alongside a very old tool ends up forming a completely singular sound, closer to modern expectations, but full of rich, evocative tones. The editing is always done with great respect, and never gratuitously, which maintains a real grog-soaked atmosphere with every step. Even seasoned hurdy-gurdy players are taken aback by Sea of Thieves, such as Neil Brook, who actually built Robin's own personal instrument.
The guy who made the hurdies, Neil Brook, he sent me a lovely email saying I've heard some of the stuff and it sounds fantastic. He said, "Is it all right if I do a version of Becalmed when I do?" Because he does like gigs in his local pub, I think, like folk nights and stuff like that. And he sent me a recording of him playing Becalmed with his mates, which was very nice. So touching when people do stuff like that and take the time to sort of learn your tunes and then send your cover versions and things like that. It's just quite humbling, really.
Simply searching Neil Brook, hurdy-gurdy, on YouTube will lead you to Neil's channel, which is filled with interesting content. It's also touching to hear his respect for Robin's music, which seems to have no problem resonating with different generations and holding up beyond the medium it was written for. Like Neil, or the befuddled concertina salesman, there are a lot of interesting personalities who pop up when discussing the music in Sea of Thieves. Robin went on a true voyage of his own as he formed his palette of sounds, helped along the way by a string of experienced professionals. But one of the key players in building his collection wasn't a musician at all. To get one of the game's most distinctive sounds, Robin would need a butcher.
I did a lot of sort of internet scouring, just sort of thinking, what's piracy? What sounds? What's kind of believable in terms of like being piracy? And I thought, well, bones is an obvious one because it's like skeletons and crossbones and stuff. And just sort of looking at various people playing rhythm bones. And I went down to the butcher's in Measham and said, I'm after some cow ribs. And he said, what are you making, spare ribs? I said, no, I'm making some rhythm bones. And he was like looking a bit puzzled at me. And I thought, well, so I took my iPad in because I thought I'm bound to get asked why. So I showed him like the wiki page of like rhythm bones. He went, all right, you want the flat ribs? He said, come back on Friday and I'll give you a bag full. So that's what I did. And he gave me like a bag full of cow bones and they were quite long. And I boiled them off in a pan and then sort of cut them to what I thought would be the right size and sanded them off and that, and then just set about trying to learn how to play them. And it took about 3 days. I mean, I'm by no means a great rhythm bone player, but I kind of can do a bit of a clackety rhythm on them. And I must have spent about 3 days in the main studio, mainly because I just didn't want to bother anybody else because it's a bit annoying. With a pair of headphones on, just because the noise was getting to my ears, and just trying to get the sort of rhythm that the sort of, you can do like a triplety thing with them. You get like a hit and a free hit when you move the bones. It's a weird thing, but you get as you move the bone back to it, so you get like a click and another click for free, and it gives you that sort of trip. It gives you that sort of trip sort of feel.
It's one thing to sit behind a keyboard or audio workstation and blast out music with an array of different sample libraries, increasingly convincing digital instruments. That approach has its own power and nuances, which are covered at length throughout this series and even later in this episode. However, it's classic Rare to go the extra mile and play with interesting textures. In fact, in all my VGM research, visiting a butcher twice, personally boiling and cutting ribs, spending days learning how to play them, and then composing a huge game's main theme around the resulting rhythm is unprecedented, even for Rare. How exactly did that main theme develop? And just how big of a role did the bones take in the process?
The Sea of Thieves main theme started on the bones. The rhythm. I was kind of just moving them in my hands when I was between sort of learning. I was just taking a break and I was just moving them about. I thought, well, that sounds like an interesting sound. Just, in fact, I've got them here. So I should be able to demonstrate. So I was just rocking them on each other. And I thought, I quite like that rhythm. So I set up the mic and just recorded that and layered them up. And then I just put like a big sort of, like a concert bass drum, like a boo. I thought that sounds quite moody, and you know, and that's how the tune started, which is quite unusual for me. I usually start on a melody or something. But that was kind of the initial seed, I suppose, if you like. I did like the bass drum, the bones, and then there's a if you get like a tam-tam, you like the big sort of tam-tam gongs. I think they sound amazing. If you just don't hit them hard, if you hit them on just lightly, softly, they have this amazing kind of moody sound to them that just sustains forever.
Not all of Robin's instrumentation for Sea of Thieves is as direct or ancient as the examples we've covered so far. The waterphone, another prominent part of the score, was only invented in the 60s. They're better suited to ambience and soundscapes than anything else, which has made them perfect for movie soundtracks. More eccentric rock musicians like Tom Waits have also been known to make use of waterphones, where they're used to set an atmosphere. So what exactly is a waterphone, and how does it fit into Sea of Thieves?
When we bought it from the son of the waterphone, like I say, the iPhone then for some reason, the waterphone inventor. And it arrived, and it was like it is two trays welded together, because it's got like the tray sort of brand underneath it, and it's got like these metal tines. I suppose the tines are tuned to certain pitches, and they're welded onto it at different varying lengths, and then there's a big tube in the middle where you hold it. It's got like cord around the top where you hold it, and that's where you pour your water into it. I suppose, you know that sound you get with a pan of water where you tap it and you move and the water, you sort of get that woo kind of sound. I mean, it's that kind of idea, I suppose, but when you bow those metal rods, you just get this incredible otherworldly sound out of it. I've said this before, the one rule with a waterphone is you just make sure you're in record, because it's fairly random what you're going to get out of it, but you just catch it right with the sort of the amount of water you've got in it and the way you're moving it, and you just catch it, and it's just get this amazing sound out of it. So that's had a fair bit of use in Sea of Thieves, actually, certainly on like the Ferry of the Damned. And I think in the wilds, if you go in the caves, I've actually stuck a shotgun mic inside it. I emptied all the water and then just put a mic right inside the waterphone and just tapped the rods and got these amazing kind of reverberant, just atmospherics out of it.
As you've heard, Sea of Thieves is brought to life by the authentic sounds Robin chose. But you've probably also noticed the more common orchestral elements that sit alongside them. This is where sample libraries come into the mix. With them, composers can effectively play anything they like through a MIDI keyboard or controller, from the most obscure ethnic flutes to gorgeous string sounds and everything in between. What comes out is made up of genuine recordings, free of any synthesis, with more advanced examples accounting for different playing styles, dynamics, and even room sizes. Though samples are increasingly sophisticated, why was it decided to go with virtual instruments over live players, and which libraries were up to the task?
It's the marvellous, wonderful fantastic Spitfire Audio libraries, who I just absolutely love. It's a mixture of all, you know, a lot of their different libraries. And I think because of the way we're putting the music together, and it is all in bits, it would have been, I think logistically, it would have been hard to sort of go and record it with an orchestra, and especially because it's like a game as a service, so we're constantly adding to it and trying various bits and bobs out with the way we're triggering the music and the way the music sort of interacts in the game. So, yeah, we decided to go down that route where I can load the sounds up and I can just have violins on their own or horns on their own or percussion on its own, and I can break them up into individual lines and melodies. And I think for me it'd be hard to sort of try and plan that out. I don't know what I'm going to come up with half the time, so...
The generative nature of Robin's soundtrack meant that live orchestral players were, for all intents and purposes, impossible to include. It's hard to even contemplate the studio bill that Rare would run up recording such subjective music, let alone the technical considerations behind its implementation in-game. Spitfire Audio and their celebrated libraries are the ideal answer to such a problem, and in the right hands, they're basically indistinguishable from a genuine performance, prized for their accuracy and detail.
The orchestral samples are just amazing. They're just the way they all sit and live together. I really don't do hardly anything to them at all. They just, because they, you know, the sort of the idea is that they have all the mics. You have the tree mic, you have the outrigger mics, and you have the close mic. So you can get the mix you want. But because it's all recorded in, a lot of it's recorded in that hall at Lyndhurst. It just, they all sit happily together, and just I never find myself having to tussle with them at all or anything like that. It just all works. And it's amazing. The way they've built on the since they started out like 12 years ago, the way the ideas and the techniques they're using now, it's just amazing. That next library that's coming out, I went to the event where they announced it, and it just sounded incredible. They've even got the mics. They've got all the mics on for the entire orchestra. So when they record the timps on that, they've got the desk one mics. The brass, everything's there to get that sound of the room within, as it would sound, to just get it sounding more authentic. But incredible, incredible stuff.
Without sample libraries, it's hard to imagine how Robin could achieve his intuitive soundtrack. I've mentioned its generative elements several times in this podcast, without going into too much depth on what that means to the game. Like Left 4 Dead or No Man's Sky, Sea of Thieves is, in many ways, scored by the player. There are few defined pieces that loop as you explore, with the music instead made up of several separate elements designed to intermingle no matter how they're sequenced or layered. Such an approach plays into the interactive nature of the medium itself, and crucially, addresses some of the tedium that can come with relentless loops.
I suppose one of my bugbears with video games is, you know, you land on a level and a piece of music starts, and it always starts in the same point. And after a while, I think if you're wanting people to play a game lots and over, I think if you, it doesn't matter how nice a bit of music sounds, I think if you've got something that's kind of starting in the same point at the same, you know, every time, I think it can start to wear thin fairly quickly. So we took that sort of decision to sort of break all the bits, all the parts into their own thing, and just let the... I like the sort of phrase of the music having a life beyond me. Once it's left me, it's the software does its own thing with it and randomises it and So all those sort of, you know, all those sort of little instruments and things have got their own sort of behaviours, and they do their own thing within the game.
There's nothing wrong with looping tunes, and they've been a huge part of VGM since it first started on rudimentary chips. But as gamers, I'm sure we've all had the same experience with certain older games. We reach that level, that one damn level, whatever it may be, which has us repeatedly restarting in a rising inferno of rage, only exacerbated by an incessant taunting melody. Dynamic scores can now do away with that frustration, and have been growing more advanced with each passing year. What was Robin's process for composing adaptive music, and how challenging is it to work within a generative system?
When you're in a certain area of the Sea of Thieves, like if you're in the Sea of Plunder or the Sea of Plenty, or you're in the wilds, it's just trying to create tone and also almost music that feels like it's just sort of blowing on the wind to a certain extent. I would set Pro Tools into record and just sort of noodle about on an instrument, and then for an hour or so, and then just go into that session and take things that I thought sounded quite nice, little sort of lines and things like that, and then just embellish those a little bit. I found it a bit of a harder way to try and approach stuff. It's just to try and get my head around it. And then when I start to try and get a bit more complicated with sort of the different chord, when on this chord you can select these melody lines, or when you're on this chord you can select these melody lines. It was that kind of gets a bit more of a task to think about it all, really, instead of just writing a piece of music that goes on a journey. You just forget how much you've actually created, how many assets and how much music you've created, and it's things like there's multiple melodies that can be triggered at any point. You know, it's not just this melody over this chord. It's like, well, you're on this chord now, so you can either pick this instrument or this one, and they've probably got maybe 8 melodies each that the software can pick. A good example of that is something like the Gold Hoarders, where you go to their tent and you've got that kind of pizzicato sort of backing, but all those lines that it plays, it can either pick a bassoon, a bass clarinet, or an oboe, or a contrabassoon, and it's doing its, you know, there's multiple melodies that the software can pick, multiple instruments that it can pick, and it's that thing of trying to stop the repetition. You don't always get that same melody each time, because you go to these, you're going to do a Gold Hoarder's Voyage quite a lot, or a Order of Souls one, so you're going to visit these people a lot, so you don't want it to be just triggering that same tune every single time you go to it.
There are more positives to writing adaptive music than simply avoiding boredom and repetition. In a game like Sea of Thieves, players are eager to roleplay as their own fantasy pirate, or in a whole crew if some friends come along. There's a lot of freedom to account for that, which the soundtrack mirrors magnificently. More traditional looping tracks have a tendency to dictate precisely how you should feel and respond at any given point. In Sea of Thieves, the score is the sound of your journey, shaped by your choices and movements, and not the other way around.
fairly early on, conversations with Greg and Mike and Joe, we don't want to be, we want this, a lot of this sort of stuff is down to player choice, and we want players to create their own stories. And I suppose a good example of that is something like the ship battles. I think sort of fairly early on I wrote some sort of music, sort of some combat, ship combat music, and they were like, no, we don't want to do, we don't want to do that, we don't want to sort of get two ships approaching each other and start firing up a bit of combat music, because it immediately puts them in that sort of frame of mind of, right, we better start firing cannons at each other. The player might not want to do that. So we stripped it right back to the point that if you are on your crew and you fire a cannonball at another ship and it hits the other ship, then you personally will get a sort of musical sting or a flourish to say, yes, you've done that. Now, you might not have intended to hit them, but at that point the cannonballs hit the ship, so you know that's where that sort of triggers off. So but it'd only you would get it on your ship, you wouldn't, the rest of the crew wouldn't hear it. And it's just a sort of not trying to infer an emotion that's might not necessarily be happening, if you see what I mean. You know, if people may just want to pull alongside each other and have a bit of a chat or play shanties together, something like that. So we just didn't want to push people in a certain path that they didn't want to go down.
As you might expect, software plays an important role in tying Robin's phrases and layers together. It's not always the case, but what's known as middleware is usually responsible for audio management in modern games. Two of the most popular are FMOD and WWISE, which you're likely to see displayed during the startup of many AAA titles. When it comes to music, they take care of channel fades, live effects, and with games like Sea of Thieves, a lot more. It's obviously an important thing to get right. So what middleware did Robin and his contemporaries at Rare settle on?
We used WWISE, and we didn't use the music part of the software, actually. We mainly sort of put a lot of the music lives in the sound effects, because it's... because you can still sort of go, well, it's this tempo, and you can go, you can sort of say, well, it's this many beats per minute, so it's easy enough to sort of slice up the time in terms of, like, seconds. You know, I would sort of say to them, I'll talk to John Vincent, the audio director, and he's written a lot of software for the music, and I'll sort of say, it'd be good if it did this, if we could do something like this, and I'll write sort of the bits, and then I'll go copy them over to him, and then we'll sit together and we'll sort of start assembling it all in WWISE. And I'll just say, at this point, I want this chord. So I suppose it'll sort of play like a little chord progression, then it will hold on a chord. So I would then get like a hurdy-gurdy line to play over that chord. So I would make it, we'll make it wait like 10 seconds, and then the hurdy's allowed to play or not play, or maybe wait and play. You know, it's got like a bit of a slew on it to say that. You can play within, you can't play before 10 seconds, but you could leave it about 15 seconds, or you know, anything a bit longer than that. So it randomises it, and then the chord will hold for anything from 10 to 30 seconds before it goes to the next progression. So it's a bit of a head scratcher at times, but it's just getting all the parts and then getting together with John and putting them together in WWISE.
Middleware like WWISE makes it a lot easier to include some very creative interactive music. It's impressive enough to compose a nebulous pool of dynamic tidbits that comfortably gel through countless variations. But adding playable instruments to the in-game universe is just another example of Rare's attention to detail. As I record this podcast, there are four in total, allowing you to jam out on your very own hurdy-gurdy, concertina, banjo or drum. The mechanic even allows for friends to accompany one another, completing the pirate experience through a number of rousing shanties.
John wrote the software for that, so that if you come up and you pick your hurdy-gurdy up and you start playing a tune, you'll be playing the melody and with a backing from your hurdy. But if I join in on a concertina, I will just play the backing, I will just accompany you. But if you then stop playing, I will start playing the melody as well. And if you join back in, then you'll start playing the backing. And then if you move around the ship or wherever we're playing, that all works, it stays in sync, and it all moves in a 7.1 soundscape as well. So it has to be able to move and stay in sync. So that was pretty involved, actually, to sort of get that up and running. We had it sort of going in the prototype fairly early on, but John had to write quite a lot of code to get all that to work. And I think because I'm in-house, I think that's enabled us to do that. I think that would be quite a hard thing to sort of get somebody to outsource that, I think. I mean, the advantage, I think, is being in-house and being able to sort of attempt this stuff and getting the nod to say yes, let just go create and be creative and just do have a play and see what you can come up with. And I think that, you know, I'm very fortunate to be in-house, and I get that sort of freedom to do that.
On long journeys across the ocean, only one thing is more important to a pirate than their faithful instrument. A reliable source of grog is required drinking for true salty sea dogs, which Rare dutifully included in Sea of Thieves. Moderation has never been a key word in the pirate vocabulary, though. And there's no better time for a musical knees-up than when you're drunk. The game accounts for any overindulgence with screen effects and an increased difficulty performing tasks, even leading, in some cases, to vomiting. When you're that far gone, you're unlikely to play anything particularly harmonious. So how did the audio team reflect that? And how do you accurately portray a drunken performance?
Ironically, the drunk shanties are all done in auto-tune. So I'd take the... I suppose initially, experimenting with it, I tried to just play wrong notes and things like that. And it just sounded a bit random. Just sounded like sort of random note generator. It didn't really sort of sound like that tune, if you know what I mean. So I then took the melody stem and stuck it in Melodyne, which is the autotune I use. And then, you know, you transfer it into the, you transfer your audio into that, and then it displays all your note information in a sort of a key roll, doesn't it? And I would just nudge the odd wrong note here and there, and then just really nudge the tuning out, just so it sounds a bit pretty sour. And that was kind of like the funny that made us laugh. I think that was the thing with the sort of drunk version of the shanties. We wanted something that would make us laugh. And that was it. It was the irony of using autotune to sort of to push it out of tune, really. And make it a bit funny. And you could sort of slide to notes in that. There's a really nice function in that where you can sort of, at the end of a note, you can almost do like a portamento sort of gliss to the next note. So that sounded pretty funny as well. But I have to say, we struggled with the drum, doing the drunken version of that for quite a while to come up with that, because the sort of Melodyne, because I don't know if you know, when you play the drum, if you want to carry the melody, it's a whistle. It's the drum, it's like the pirate whistling the melody. And we tried sort of doing that thing with the melodyne and sticking it and making the notes just shoving them out a little bit out of tune and stuff and putting there, but it just sounded really odd. And we went round and round and sort of tried different things with it and eventually sort of landed upon, well, if you were drunk and trying to whistle, you probably wouldn't be able to whistle. So it's sort of, you'll have, you know, the sort of sober version would be like, but if you're had a few, it's sort of more like a, you know, kind of blowing and just not being able to sort of get your lips into the position. And that was, again, it was like, let's go for the what makes us laugh. And that was a sort of more comedic version of it. So that's, yeah, I suppose it's that thing of just being in a sort of that sort of team thing of what you're just trying to make each other laugh and stuff. And it sort of rubs off into the game.
Similar creative attitudes can be found in the audio of basically every Rare release since the mid-90s. It reminds me of the musical wildlife on certain Donkey Kong or Banjo-Kazooie tracks, or references to pop music slipped into GoldenEye. They're playful and somewhat amusing ideas, but they still manage to deepen the experience with memorable details. Clearly, a lot of effort went into Drunk Shanties, making them much more interesting than other systems that simply use catch-all filters instead. The Chest of 1,000 Groks, an in-game treasure you can find in several ways, provides yet another way for the player to get out of their god, accompanied by its own seedy soundscape that stumbles away in the background.
The notes are chopped up into the individual notes of Drunken Sailor, and then it's just as you're carrying it's tied to like the animation then. So as you're sort of going faster and slower, it kind of goes up in pitch and, you know, faster, and then slows down as you're stumbling around. That one was, I think that Guillaume put that in, one of our other sound designers, and I just gave him the individual and he just the individual notes, and then he tied it into, yeah, I suppose just like the speed of it kind of slowing and speeding up as you're sort of staggering about the place.
The Chest of 1,000 Groks and the wider Drunken Shanties you can perform on a whim are just two examples of how much work goes into a modern game soundtrack. In the 80s, and on into the 90s, space limitations resulted in a handful of different level tunes, a title track, and maybe a couple of boss themes per release. That's a far cry from the infinitely generative scores of today, which often need ongoing support from developers. The job might even call for original music to use outside of the game, like in trailers or other promotional material. Such pieces can actually sit among a title's most popular tunes, perfectly demonstrated by We Shall Sail Together, which first appeared in footage for 2016's E3.
Like, what's the most well-known shanty? I suppose, yes, Drunken Sailor, probably. So why don't we take that melody, but we'll have our own lyrics that sort of chime more with Sea of Thieves. It was quite a process, sort of landing onto that tune and sort of thinking what should we go for with this? What should we, you know? And then Chris Alcock wrote the lyrics for it, and then we got everybody here to sort of just add vocal parts and stuff like that. I mean, you see, that was built out of all stuff that was in the game, really. There were some things that were written for, like the way you held the lantern up to the shrine. That was written for the trailer, but then the plan was always we were going to be using that in-game. So it's stuff that we know we're going to use anyway. But a lot of those kind of bits of music are actually rebuilt from the interactive stuff in game, and trying to make that into a go on a bit of a journey. You're taking something that's interactive and in bits, and you're trying to put it into something that's linear and make it kind of go on a bit of a path. Which is, a lot of people asking about the soundtrack, and that's one of the challenges we have with the soundtrack.
Official, releasable soundtracks of generative scores are tough to tackle. The music in Sea of Thieves is so closely tied to the medium it was written for that much of it doesn't suit a traditional OST album. Some tracks have shown up on streaming platforms and could be formed into an enjoyable and faithful playlist, but there's a lot of missing material too. Fans have been hoping for a more complete official soundtrack since the game's debut, but actually curating one is its own challenge. Since it seems a full score will eventually be forthcoming, what's its current status, and how is Robin approaching it?
Yeah, no, still working on it. And it's got a bit of a twist as well, so... but I won't say any more about that. But yeah, it's that thing of taking music that... I mean, I suppose you could have just hooked up Wise and just recorded from the game and stuck that out, but that just sort of feels a bit phoned in to me. The reason it's built the way it is in the game is because we want it to be interactive. We don't want it to be repetitive, and it's because it's not a linear thing. Games aren't linear. It should have a life of its own and be this sort of living, breathing entity within Sea of Thieves. But when you're then sort of trying to transfer that into something that's a listenable experience, and that's all you're doing, and that's another challenge that I've had to sort of try to assemble it and make it have a bit of a flow and go on a bit of a journey.
Official soundtracks are made even harder to produce when a game just won't stop adding content. Tall Tales, and a string of other updates, have not only kept the melodic landscape of Sea of Thieves fresh, but they've also allowed Robin to compose in different ways. Being more linear, the Tall Tales make heavier use of traditional, structured pieces, for instance. And it's really up to Rare just how much music is still to come, with no particular reason to stop while there's still wind in the sails.
We did the whole sort of like the anniversary update. We did Tall Tales campaign without, for the people that wanted more of a sort of single player narrative driven campaign. So that's been sort of fairly linear pieces of music. The puzzle vaults are pretty interactive. We're sort of interacted, but sometimes we've just sort of gone like, let's just play a piece of music. Like let's play a boss piece, which is different to like where you would meet the Kraken or the Megalodon or something like that. Which is those are very sort of interactive pieces. We've just kind of gone let's do a kind of a piece that goes on a bit of a journey. But yeah, it's constantly sort of listening to the community and responding to that and what people like, and so you, which I think is a sort of really fantastic way to make a game, sort of bringing the community along and listening to them and sort of seeing, you know, trying to sort of think about what the sort of stuff it sparks. It just sparks off ideas in the development of the game as well.
It's difficult to know how to sum up the audio of a game like Sea of Thieves quickly. With its array of fascinating instruments and top-level orchestral libraries, brought together by a clever generative system, it's a title that pushes modern VGM to its very limits. Then again, Rare have always treated music as a priority. To them, sound is integral to the gaming experience at every step, meaning their staff role of composers over the years reads like a list of VGM royalty. With Rare, David Wise got the very best out of the Nintendo Entertainment System and its Super sequel. Then, with the famed N64, the company helped start the career of Grant Kirkhope, who often worked alongside Graham Norgate and, of course, Robin Beanland.
At Rare, we've always tried to make the music do something a bit different, because it's not video games aren't a linear medium, are they? There's a lot of down to player choice and stuff. So I think, you know, going back to like the N64 stuff, we always sort of tried to do the channel fading things and stuff like that in the MIDI files. But yeah, with Sea of Thieves, I suppose that's the kind of thing over the years. It's just trying to think, what can we do next? What can we do that's, you know, where can we take it now?
Thanks to Robin for speaking to me for the sound test, but thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you may be listening on. Next, I'll go from the seas to the stars as I launch into the mysterious outer wilds, joined by composer Andrew Pralo. We talk about his mesmerising music and sound design for one of 2019's most acclaimed games, and it's not to be missed for anyone with a soft spot for sci-fi. If you'd like to hear that podcast early, ahead of public release, head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave. There, you can pledge your support for as little as a single pound or dollar to unlock early access to podcasts, unedited interviews, full quality WAV files, a full backlog of otherwise unavailable live shows, and more. Finally, don't forget to join me every Friday, 7 p.m. GMT, for a live and interactive show of VGM.